Harihi Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahavirayam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Tattva Sandarbha Adhyayana 3 Adhikarna 2 Understanding the Jiva and the Supreme Brahman Srila Baladeva Vibhushan. It is said that if Jiva is understood as Atma, Paramatma can be easily understood. For that purpose, the author gives quotations while describing the Jiva. He quotes from Brahma Sutra. The Dahara Vidya in Chandogya Upanishad says, Yaridam asmin brahmapure baharam pundarikam veshma daharo smin antar akashas tasmin yet antas tad anvesh tavyam. In the city of Brahman, there is a small lotus dwelling. That dwelling is small. In that place, there is an inner space. Within that space is that which should be sought. Chandogya Upanishad 8.1.1. Okay. Just, I hear a cat, but I look over there, there's a bird, so. They're learning tricks.
So, Maharaj, what is the meaning?
Oh, okay.
Brahman.
Explain in the next paragraph.
In the next paragraph. Okay. The body of the worshiper is the city of Brahman. In that body, one should meditate on Paramatma in the space situated in the lotus of the heart. It is taught that one should seek out that form endowed with the eight qualities, starting with freedom from sin. Footnote 20. The eight qualities from freedom from sin. Freedom from are freedom from sin, freedom from old age, freedom from death, freedom from sorrow, freedom from hunger, freedom from thirst, satyakama and satyasankalpa. Chandogya Upanishad 8.7.3. This is the conclusion. And so we see is that in the Vedic Sanskrit we're talking about, everything's very hidden. You know, so that other day that but you're taking the Upanishad, you know, the Veda and giving it different meanings. It says this is how the meanings work. You know, it's not direct like, you know, the Gita Shloka. That's direct. You know, this is how Vedic Sanskrit is.
So we can say that Shruti, they're always indirect and they're always in Vedic Sanskrit, and Smriti would be in classical.
Means that the Shruti is always in Vedic. And the anything other than the Vedas themselves, that's all in classical Sanskrit. Like
that's
that.
Why it's more direct?
It's more, but it tends to be more poetic, like that, more direct. But in any case, Sanskrit always has, because when you're dealing with things, you find that you're explaining that much of the time one likes to use kind of like more... I say subtle presentations. You know, it's just a common thing. But you'll see is that the Veda tends to do it more like that. If the classical is doing that, generally it's being poetic, right? And so that poetic generally means it has more the kind of emotional and those kind of aspects to it. But we see in the Vedic when it's being poetic like that, it's more intellectual. Like that. So it's a different kind of poetry. We're not quite used to that so much. Yeah. In that section, there's also the following. Evam evaisha samprasado smat sharirat samutaya param jyotir upasampadya svena rupena bhini spadyate sa uttama purusha. Receiving realization rising from his body, he attains the supreme light and manifests with his own form. The Lord is the supreme person. Chandogya Upanishad 8:12-3. So then he gives the meaning. Receiving realization, samprasada, the jiva attains the supreme light, which is the supreme person, Uttama Purusha. Why is the jiva discussed in Dahara Vidya? Brahma Sutra 1.3.20 says, jiva is discussed for another purpose. End quote. The jiva attaining Paramatma attains the sarup for the purpose of knowing Paramatma. Sa uttama purushaha. Right, so a sarup means as servant of the Lord. Right, that's the actual. Krishna says that jiva sarup hoi Krishna nitya das. Right, so that's the sarup of the jiva. Then there may be a specific application of that sarup. But that's the sarup. Because if you're not starting with that, the other sarup doesn't have any meaning.
As jivas, we all in dasya with Lord Chaitanya.
Yes.
And then with Krishna, we have different sarups.
Yes, but it's all as servant.
Based on the platform of dasya also.
It's not based on the platform of dasya. It's just based on that it's all service. Because dasya means that the rendering specific service. That's what's that's the prominent element. But when you get up more, is that it takes on, you know, the more intimacy and all that. So it doesn't, it takes on that mood of service from the aspect of a particular relationship rather than service is the relationship. So it's service in a particular flavor. Is that? Yes.
Words like Purusha or Uttama Purusha, it means Bhagavan or Paramatma or both.
It's just a matter of your realization. But the point is, when it says Uttama Purusha, then you're knowing the Lord. But the point is, he's sitting in your heart as Paramatma. So at least you should know that much, and then from there you can progress farther. Does that make sense? Yeah. There are six transformations: birth, existence, growth, transformation, decline, and death. These do not exist in the jiva, right? They're in the body. But so in the material world, you'll see this with anything that has form. But the jiva doesn't have this. The Lord doesn't have this, right? These are phenomena of the material world. Quote, the jiva is a form of knowledge. So is this going to be again the Buddhist?
It is the Purvapaksha.
Okay. So the Purvapaksha. It might be worthwhile putting in the note or something. The jiva is a form of knowledge, but knowledge becomes blue or yellow, right? See, they're sticking to that again, right? Oh, now they picked yellow instead of not red. Right? Last time was red. Huh? It was also yellow. Okay. It is thus not eternal. So then now the Uttara. The jiva is also a knower. This is like the sun, which is self revealing object, which reveals other things. Knowledge itself is eternal, since it is related to the surupa, the jiva. Perception of blue takes place through the senses and pranas. The functions, senses, contacting objects, taking the form of blue, etc., appear and then disappear. Right? So the jiva doesn't. Knowledge itself doesn't. It's just a particular aspect of knowledge, you know, that's gained through the senses. That you are then, that is what's temporary. That's what's coming and going.
That's what we are saying.
Yes, that's what we're saying. They're saying is that jiva is a form of knowledge, but knowledge becomes blue or yellow, so thus it is not eternal, so the jiva is not eternal. So they've already said that knowledge is not eternal, jiva is knowledge, so it's also not eternal.
Who is eternal in their conception?
Nothingness. So the point is eternal is a quality, but nothingness has no quality, so why would they be worried about eternal? They'd be worried about nothing. So that's why all these contradictions will always come up, because you can't, these aren't bona fide philosophies. So they only, in their mind, it sounds good to them, so they go for it.
And they consider themselves Jesus?
No.
Brahman, or nothing?
Nothing. They're trying to just be nothing. The idea is, their example is, the perfection is, you have a candle, you just blow out the candle, and now it's perfect. Like, you know, there's something wrong here. You know, it's just like you get a bunch of teenagers together and they get one of those shopping carts, you know, that you use in the, you know, go buy groceries and the thing, and they have a hill. So in their mind, it's a fabulous idea to get inside and ride down the hill. Right, so that's the whole point. Is just because they're talking and walking, and that doesn't mean that they're coming up with great ideas. To them, it sounds great because of the modes of nature, but in reality, it's not so great. You know, it seems great for part of the way, you know, like that. So, yeah. Riti from Sri Jivatoshini. The objection of the Kshanika Vijnanavadis, that's the kind of Buddhists, right?
Kshanika means momentary.
Momentary. Oh, so momentary knowledge. The momentary knowledge. So so their knowledge about knowledge is also momentary. they're thinking their knowledge is eternal, but if knowledge is temporary, then their knowledge is also temporary. But, you know, that's how it goes, right? The objection of the Kshanika Vijnanavadis discussed in the previous Anucheda is repeated here and answered differently. The momentary consciousness of which they speak actually changes in the mental state. It is produced by the senses interacting with the external world. Consciousness itself is constant. Vedanta explains that when a person looks at an object, it creates a particular mental state called vritti. This vritti is perceived by the soul. The mental state is itself the perceiver. The mental state is not itself the perceiver. The Buddhists, however, lacking all knowledge about the soul, mistake this vritti, which is non-eternal and undergoes changes at every moment, to be the real consciousness. So they can't tell the difference between the actual consciousness and the perception itself. So, and they actually also don't even understand knowledge. So they don't understand that this is just, you know, within knowledge, they're perceiving a particular temporary aspect, because knowledge means it can be about anything, you know, that has. So you happen to be focusing on this aspect of knowledge. Because otherwise, basically in their mind, it's like, I'm looking this side of the house. And so, because I'm looking at it, it's there. The other side of the house doesn't even exist. And only when I look back, now it exists, and this side disappears. You know, according to this. But the point is knowledge is always there. It's just a matter of which aspect you're looking at. And then the soul is behind that and is perceiving that knowledge through the senses. So because they don't know the soul, they don't actually understand consciousness. Right, so they don't actually understand how anything fits together. So they have a little bit of knowledge, right? You know, because they would have picked it up from the Vedas. But that's the difficulty, is that's all the more they have. Because Buddha would have explained things. There was no written scriptures or anything, just his discussions. And so then all those Brahmins and all that would have been, you know, impressed with Buddha and taken that up, they would then base their stuff back on the Vedas, because they were all scholars. Yes.
Do they know where they take their knowledge? Do they know where they take the knowledge? Like when they, it's from the Veda, but do they know?
Not necessarily. I mean, it's been a long time.
That's okay.
Right, because they're just going on the what they've heard from Buddha, and so then, having heard from him, then they're going to understand according to their own perception. Because the point is, Buddha came to bewilder them. Right?
Okay.
You know, so it doesn't matter. Like one of the most famous, how you say, you know, presentations he made was the what is that? The, I forget what it's called. Lecture, yeah, the one of the rows. Lecture of the rows or that. So everyone's there, and he just held up a rose, said nothing, and everyone just sat there for whatever it was, you know, an hour, whatever they normally sit there for. And so everybody's speculating on what it means and this and that. So each one could be doing their own thing. It doesn't matter as long as they're, you know, just doing something that they're being becoming nonviolent. So the whole point was to make them nonviolent. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So the whole point is you can't try to make sense out of what is being said, because it's all under the control of the modes of nature. So the only thing that makes sense is how it doesn't make sense. They catch certain things because, see, people have to make, you have to, means the whole point that's being made here in that the acharyas are pointing out is that you learn about the Lord by learning about the soul. Because you have some connection with the soul, means being ourselves, right? We don't know the Lord. So then understanding the soul, then you can take it further to understand the Lord. Because he's the supreme soul. You know, he's the origin. In other words, you can look at it, you have the cause and then the effect. Like I talk about earth, and then I make a pot, so I can see earth in the pot. But I can talk about the pot and the qualities of the pot, and because it's made from earth, I can see it that way, back that way. So they're talking about that the living entity is going to work from their what they understand already. You can't work outside of that. So you always have to take something new has to be compared to something you already know. And that, so if there may be it's just one step and maybe a few steps. Mm-hmm. So without proper guidance, then in making those steps, you can come up with all kinds of weird things.
And that's where they are now. It's all weird.
Yes, yes, like that. All the anything other than Vaishnavism is weird. But the point is because they can only go by things that are known, then you'll see that there'll be, you know, quite a few common elements between all philosophies, right? Because they're all working on the same common experience. You know, so it's like let's say if we have a religion, is it strange if it has rituals?
It's
no,
not strange.
No, right? That because that's what's going on.
Yes.
So people can relate to that, and so then they don't have any. They're creating a new religion. They create their own rituals. You know what I'm saying? Because it's just like where does how do you say like Christian rituals? Where do they come from? It's originally from Judaism, but then with Paul it's rejected. So that means they have to take something from that past and something from, because they're Romans, and something from what they do and kind of smoosh it all together. So they created a new religion. It's an old philosophy. It's the Judaic philosophy. But it's a new religion. Right? Because they started from scratch. So where did it come from? Because at least the Judaic, at least according to history, is God's coming and telling them stuff to do. But we don't see anything where God's telling them what to do in the Christianity. So they're just putting it together. Because the living entities, you know, always worship, always do this and that, you know, in all the different lifetimes. So they have that kind of samskar. So they have to put something together. You know? Does that make sense? So all the philosophies will be like that. They're taking something from the Vedic, but they only relate to logic, so then they'll make a whole religion based around that.
The point is it's all coming from the Vedic, and they all make different logic, and they start new things.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's just the way it is. That's why without guidance, then you can come up with all kinds of wild stuff.
It's all wired.
Huh?
So it's all wired. If it's just
basic. Yeah, it always is. Because it's a speculation.
Yes.
You know.
Thank you so much.
It's like fusion cooking by not a very good cook. You know, someone who doesn't really know how to cook then does fusion cooking.
Cooking everything.
It starts to get more crazy. You know. How you say? Yeah. Yeah. It becomes weird.
It becomes crazy.
Yeah. But people, because of the modes, then they're comfortable with that. They're okay. Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, mostly, don't follow to the principle of non-violence, except Theravada's direction. But many of them develop mystical powers. They want to ask how it's possible if they don't follow the proper process and if they don't have a proper process.
The point is mystic powers proper? What's it for? I mean, what is the benefit? Does the mystic powers benefit the soul? Right? And so as we mentioned before, these mystic powers that they're getting that from Tantra. And that they picked up, you know, in Assam. Like that. So they're Bengali Tantrics. That's
lots.
Yeah. Does that make sense? It's just pick it up from there. You follow the Tantra, then it works. You have your bead syllables, you do your meditation, this, that. Yeah, it's just tricks. You know, it's like Prabhupada told the story that there were two friends, you know, as kids they grew up, and that one friend went off. And he came back after a long time. And he says, oh, what have you been doing? You know, he's been, you know, some places, some yogis and meditating and that. And he says, you know, like that, and worked very hard, you know, so for, you know, like, so many years, like 12 years and like that. And he came back and he says, I wanted to show you something. So then, that friend, then he went and he walked across the river that was there. You know? And so he came back and then says, you know, like that. And so the friend wasn't impressed. Like that. He says, you know, like that, they're walking on the water, that's, you know, it's amazing. Why aren't you impressed? He says, it's a 2 paise trick. He says, I paid 2 paise to the boatman and he'll take me across. And I didn't have to work for 12 years. I just have to get 2 paise. You know. So that's the whole thing, is that it's impressive for them because it's something somebody else can't do. But so what? You know, it's just like, let us say, you have, you know, like an Olympic champion in something, right? And so what they do, others can't do. And they work very hard and all that to do that. No? But it doesn't, just because but it's not that they have to be non-violent to do it. You work with, you manipulate the material energy according to the rules, you'll get that effect. Does that make sense? And so that's all they're doing. But it's coming from the Tantra, and so then, you know, it gets weird.
It says Vriti here.
Vriti?
Yeah.
This one here.
Yeah, on top. What does that mean?
What does this Vriti mean? It means the word Vriti.
Yeah.
It means notes.
Notes?
Notes. So the Vriti means it's our notes. Okay.
Yeah. People ask me.
Oh, okay. No, it's just our notes. Okay. The momentary consciousness of which they speak, the Buddhists, is actually the changes of the mental state. It is produced by the senses interacting with the external world. Right? So you're conscious and then the mind takes on this form. Right? That's the whole thing. It takes on that. So it's not the consciousness. Mm-hmm. Like that.
Mark, regarding this, when the mind takes that form, really he accepts or rejects, and then when we decide to do that, can we say then the intelligence takes that mode and the consciousness as well?
No, it means that still the mind is going to be dealing with the senses. The intelligence is used as as how you say, the analytical aspect to work things out, what to do and all that. But it's the mind that's controlling the scene. This is the mind is the one that is, it's decided what we're going to analyze, what we're going to apply. So it's coming from the mind. The intelligence just analyzes what's there. It's just like who runs the computer. You understand? It's us. We're running the computer. But the computer does all the calculations and stuff like that. But you make the decisions. So the intelligence is working for the mind. That's why then when we start to use the intelligence to control the mind, because then we're trying to use it for the higher, the consciousness, then it takes on a different flavor. Now the mind, the intelligence, the false, the ego, then are supportive of the consciousness. But if not, the mind just runs the show. That's what he's saying, is that you're going by impressions. So what you have, where you have favorable impressions, that's where you're going to work. You're not going to work where you don't have favorable impressions.
Impressions are stored in the consciousness. So yeah. They're pulled out by the intelligence when the mind gets some ideas.
But because the memory is there, and so then the mind accesses the memory. But it's a part of intelligence. So some, not, you know, how you say, because it's practically applied that way, they'll generally tend to put that the memory is part of the citta, the mind. But the difficulty is, yes, that's how it's practically being applied, but it's actually a function of the intelligence. Right? Because the citta means a polluted consciousness. And so that means then the mind is working in a way that's mundane. But the point is so it's that whole aspect together, but still you can break it down. So one has to be very, very careful is that one doesn't, in using the practical, forget actually the elements you're working with. Does that make sense? It's just like, let's say we're making a chaunce. So the principle of the chaunce is one thing, but what we put in the chaunce, that's details. But let's say one is doing a particular kind of cooking. Let's say they always use, mustard seeds and some cumin seeds, right? And so then because that's how you're using it, then it's taken that a chaunce means that. And it may mean in that particular context, but it actually doesn't mean that. It means that you're heating oil and then tempering some spices in that oil. That's the chance. But because they're always using in that way, then they take it that means chance. It may in that context, but that's not actually the meaning. So the citta then, when we're talking about it in general, we're meaning the consciousness that is polluted. But when you're practically using it in the process of reasoning in that, then the mind is going to be, using the consciousness. And then with the help of the memory, the intelligence, then it'll deal with the impressions. Then it will analyze with the mechanics of the intelligence, and then based on the identity and all that, then you'll be able to apply it. Because you can't apply something if you don't have an identity in that situation. But if you're in the kitchen, unless you identify as the cook, how do you cook? You identify as the pot washer, you wash pots.
So, yes. To have a good mechanics, you have to study the Vedas. Like if you want
means to you have to study under the acharyas.
Yes.
That has to be done.
Yeah. Otherwise, it becomes all weird.
Yes, then it goes. It becomes strange. It becomes what you'd say perverted or distorted, like this. So they're taking maybe something that's correct, but it becomes distorted. It's just like, let's say, you have one of those mirrors that are kind of a concave or convex. So if you stand in front of them, you look really fat or really thin.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's a distortion. It's not that it's not the an actual reflection. It's a real reflection, but it's a distorted reflection. So the particular points that are made in the Vedas, then they become distorted because of these different perceptions. So you come up with different philosophies. You know, something's important for them.
When you see somebody acting weird, like doing some action, and you like to say, maybe you should learn about the Vedas, and maybe they are so strong in their mentality, they would, I don't know, because the world is crazy. And
But you start with that yourself understanding this, so you're not crazy.
Yeah.
And then the whole point is if you're going to discuss that with somebody, then the point is then the thing is as we mentioned, you have to go from something that's of value to something else. So then the difficulty here is you say they have to learn from the Veda. So if they have no idea what the Veda is, that won't mean anything.
Okay.
And then you have the aspect of learning. Is that important to them? Do they see that by learning that, you know, you get something of value? So unless you show that, then you show then where the authority is and then the Veda is and then like that. So you always have to take it from their position. And then means you're going to speak from your realization, but you have to present it according to the position of the person you're presenting it to.
Yes. Maybe it doesn't, they won't care. Like if they don't know, it doesn't, if they don't care and they it's not meaningful to them.
Yeah, they won't.
Then
they won't.
I don't give any energy.
Yeah, yeah. So basically you have so preaching means you, according to your realization, try to explain Krishna consciousness in the context of the particular person's situation and experience. And then bring them through that. Right? So now, when we have, you know, these contemporary concepts of hard preaching, that means I am using my realization but not in the context of the other person's position or situation. I'm just presenting it how it works for me without actually bringing it to the... So that's why it's hard preaching. You know, it's called hard because, you know, being a devotee, you can be a little bit, you know, serious about it, and so therefore it's considered hard. But what's left out is that you're speaking according to your realization. That's correct. But you're not putting it in the context of the person you're talking to. Then soft preaching, then we're doing the opposite. We're considering the person, their situation and context, but not our realization. So at least the one, they're hearing some spiritual, you know, subject matter and all that. And, you know, you'll hear a devotee say, yeah, I came to the temple and they were so, you know, what they're preaching was so heavy and all that and it turned me off, so I went away and everything like that. But the point is you're a devotee now. So you did think about it. While those guys down at the yoga studio, they're still not chanting. You know, so, you know, that's the fun point. Devotees talk about the hard preaching and all that, but they're all devotees. Because they came in contact with the chit potency. With the soft preaching, it's like, where's the chit potency? So it's niyamagraha. One is it's all about the rules, and the other is that we don't know the rules, so we throw it out. So they're both a problem. So preaching means you, according to your realization, speak according to the consciousness, the position, the experience, the understanding of who you're talking to, and make it relevant to them. That's what Prabhupada said. It means that we give relevant instruction. We take what Prabhupada said in the Acharyas and make it relevant for the person we're talking to. That's preaching. Right? You know, that's all Bhaktivinoda Thakura explains like that. You see, it's just all that Krishna explains like that in the 11th canto. It's just, this is preaching. So people not understanding preaching, then they do either hard or soft. But both of those are weak because they're not as efficient. Right? But at least the hard preaching people will appreciate your conviction in that, even though they don't like what you're saying. But they'll like that. You know, the other one, you're a nice guy, but you know, there's so many nice guys. You know, it's like, you know, especially nowadays, you know, everyone's trying to be the nice guy. You know. And if they're really into nice guys, they should move to Portland. Yes.
Impressions a person gets from Bhakti, and sometimes we see like it's like kind of not enough. The person is he gets some impressions of devotional service, but then like is it his mind which is like becomes too strong that he cannot continue, or is it like not enough? Like, Sukriti, can you explain this?
It's just a matter of the purification of the heart. If there's too much material desire, then one will continue to follow that. You know what I'm saying? That's why then you're always trying to keep good association and proper practices. So that in that one stays steady in devotional service. Because you become steady by removing anartas. So if the anartas are remaining in the heart because of, you know, then there's one's not steady. So depending on how unsteady that is, that may define their position. Yeah, so the point is you're trying to create as much possible of regular association and that, so that there's a proper understanding. As we saw yesterday, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is making the point that you must have the proper sambandha jnana, right, of Krishna and who he is, in other words, chitta chitishwara, knowing the Lord, the living entity and the material nature and their relationship, you know, the factual relationship. Based on that, then you can properly perform devotional service. Otherwise, if the material energy is more prominent or important, then they can get distracted. So it's just a matter of a balance between how much they're distracted and how much they're engaged in devotional service. Yeah. And everybody's an individual, so they're going to make their own choices. You know, as a preacher, you do the best you can to try to expose them to, you know, very nice. Does that make sense?
Srila Prabhupada told that if you teach to the people of the one followers to another religion, you should not convince them to change their faith to the religion, but you should help them to improve their
yes.
And if some people add some elements of bhakti to their practice, for example, chant and faith, but in philosophical way and in another practice, they will still follow to their own religion. What will be the, without accepting authority of pure devotees and without accepting authority of acharya, what will be the result? Just agyata sukriti?
Yes. Agyata sukriti. Because until they have that firm faith, then only at that point is called Shraddha. Because basically is they're accepting a moral standard because it will give them good material benefit. You know, either benefit now or, how you say, you know, a whole lot of green embroidered couches with virgins on them. Right? So...
Many.
Yeah, many. I mean, it seems to be with time the number goes up.
Motivate people.
Yeah, no, motivate. You know, I think I can't remember what it was I heard before. Originally, 16? I can't. Huh?
16 first.
16 is where it started. I heard now they're up to like 70, like that. You know, so. I mean, yeah. So the whole point is you're trying to bring out is because being that it's about the monotheistic aspect is you're trying to bring it out about that worship of God, that devotion towards God. So that's the aspect you're trying to cultivate, developing pure devotion. So that's what will be discussed about. So it's more of you're dealing with the philosophy, not the religion. Right? In other words, they have their religion that they're practicing. But the philosophy, the monotheism, you're trying to take them deeper in the understanding of that. Does that make sense? And so then they'll, you know, they can practice what they're doing better, or they may, depending upon their position, might want to take up the devotional process as we're following. Does that make sense? So those who don't really, it means they say they're a particular religion but don't really follow anything from it, then for them they're not really following any religious process. They're only following the contemporary, you know, bourgeois kind of, Protestant concept of social standing, you know, the secular kind of thing. So they don't really have any religious thing other than the modern, how you say, consumerist society. So then for them to take up Krishna consciousness, then it's not a problem. But if they actually are, you know, serious in their practices, it's just a matter of understanding what they're doing, so they start to understand there's something beyond karma and jnana. You know, pure devotional service is actually the position. But having that faith and having that focus and all that, then that's good. Because otherwise, the philosophy is the main point, or you can discuss. It's the religion that you don't get involved in. Other than the sub-dharma, the religion of the soul, to serve the Lord. But the external, you know, the language, the rituals they use and this and that, you don't touch on those. You don't have to start touching on those. You know, it's the principles you'll deal with. So they're using their detail, but you'll discuss the principle of it. So that means you need to know the principles. So that's why that's the important aspect. Because otherwise, then again, we have is that in hard preaching, we're taking the ritual of Krishna consciousness or the religion of Krishna consciousness and not understanding so much the philosophy. So we're presenting more the Krishna conscious religion, but not so much philosophy. And then when you're dealing with the soft preaching, you're using instead of, you know, so that's considered hard. And so then, you know, because it has conclusion, it has focus, it has that. So it's by the modern context, because it's the modern context that is called hard and soft. It's not from the Vedic context. So then, taking it from this modern context, then instead of, again, preaching the philosophy, they'll preach New Age religion. And somehow the New Age has that, reputation for being, you know, soft and nice and accommodating and wonderful and fabulous and universal and all that kind of jazz. You know, so someone from that kind of background will, you know, if they don't use the Vedic religion, they'll fall into their, you know, whatever their old religious habit. Okay. Is that what it is? Yeah. Okay, the momentary consciousness of what they speak is actually the changes in the mental state. It is produced by the senses interacting with the external world. Consciousness itself is constant. Vedanta explains that when a person looks at an object, it creates a particular mental state called vritti. This vritti is perceived by the soul. The mental state is not itself the perceiver. The Buddhists, however, lacking all knowledge about the soul, mistake this vritti, which is not eternal and undergoes changes at every moment, to be the real consciousness. So it is only the mental state affected by the varieties of sense perception that appears and disappears or undergoes changes, not the self. The living entity is a fraction of the Lord, and since the Lord is conscious and eternal, the living entity must have these qualities as well, inasmuch as the tiny gold nugget has the qualities of the source lode. But the purpose of explaining the conscious and eternal quality of the soul with logic and personal experience is to develop an understanding of the supersoul. Surely, so that's the whole point. It's not just to speculate and have some fun. It's actually to understand the supersoul. Srila Jiva Goswami concludes two different types of arguments from the words of Pipalayana, Srimad Bhagavatam 11.3.38, to distinguish the soul from the material body. The first argument is based on the changes occurring in the material body. We see the changes in the course of time. Yet we do not think that we ourselves have changed. We know ourselves to be the same person. Since the attributes of the changelessness and transformations cannot be attributed to the same object, the unchanging soul must be distinct from the changing body. Right? I mean, because we compare the soul eternality of the soul with the body, right? And so since the body is temporary, it can't also be eternal, right? So now in the temporary change, it's there, the body's changed, but you identify as the same person. You know, yeah, when I was 5, I did this, and when I was 15, I did that, and does that make sense? It's the same person, even though the body's transforming and changing. You know, even the modern kind of element that's saying that the cells of the body change, you know, after some time, it's completely new. Ayurveda mentions 7 years. I'm not sure what the modern says, but, you know, so everything's changed.
They also say 7.
So it's just, that's there. So everything's changed. So if you're the body, then everything's changed. So the consciousness is constant. That means that being constant aspect and the other changing, they can't be the same thing. They have to be two different things. Mm-hmm. So that's that first logical argument. The second
Sometimes we feel that there is one point to accept that we are not the body, we are the soul.
Yes.
But the next difficulty is we are the mind.
Yes. Well, we start with the gross body because that's where the main identity is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Then comes the mind. Some people, that is their main identity, but that is very rare. They're generally very kind of mental people.
Mm-hmm.
But for most, it's the body. And then, as you dig into it, then you see the mind is there, or the intelligence. Like you get into the academics, their mm-hmm. intelligence is their identity. I'm so smart. Mm-hmm. You know, and they may be compared to other people. But it's still... Just because you have a better quality tool doesn't mean that you actually know what it's for. You know, it's just like, just because you have a nicer car doesn't mean you know how to drive any better than anybody else. Right? So it's not that the intelligence makes you intelligent. Because intelligence is an element of matter. While the soul is something else. Is spirit. So, just because the soul has a quantity of mundane matter that may be of better quality than someone else's or more volume, it doesn't mean that the soul itself is intelligent. So when we say someone's a fool, we're meaning on the platform of consciousness.
Yes.
The soul itself is foolish. We're not saying he doesn't have sharp intelligence. Yes. It's just that his sharp intelligence can only function in the context of the material world. It can't function in the context of the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not without parampara, without spiritual master. So unless the chit potency is there, you can't understand spirit. You know, it's just like if when you're seeing there's no colors, can you understand color? Like if I'm seeing in black and white, can I therefore, by my black and white and analyzing all that, can now I see color? No, never. So you can see color, then you can analyze in color. So the whole point is that the mind, the intelligence being a material element, it can only deal with is the accesses to the material elements. So the 24 elements, it can play with that. But the spiritual is something else. So unless there's the connection with the spiritual potency, the chit potency, it can't work with it. You can't work with something that's not there. Right? I can't make dinner if there's no ingredients. You're going to say, no, but I got the best pots and all that. It says, yeah, but you can't cook without ingredients. No, but this pot cost, you know, had 300 euros and all that, and it's the best, and all the chefs in the world, this is the pot, and what do you mean I can't cook without ingredients? I got the best pots around. My pots are better than your pots. What are you talking about, you know? So that's what we're dealing with here. That foolishness. That this idea that because I have... you know, logical intelligence or, you know, a modern degree and all that, therefore I can understand anything. That is really, really foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just a tool. It's a dead element. It's subtler than this table. But it's as dead as this table.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only because the consciousness of there's the jiva that you see that there's some, it works. Like, I can have the best machine in the world, but if I don't plug it in, it doesn't work. Right? So it's the consciousness. And the whole point is the consciousness, the polluted consciousness, is also a material element. So unless it's endowed and imbued with the spiritual chit potency, it cannot analyze spiritual. Doesn't matter what anybody says. Get all the PhDs in the world together in a big stadium, and they all say, no, you can do it. It doesn't matter. You know, if they all say, we can fly, you know, all we have to do is flap our arms. It's not going to happen. That's the point. Prabhupada says, a million fools say a lie is the truth. It doesn't make it the truth. They may amongst themselves accept it and pat each other on the back and say, you're so fabulous. You know, it's like the Mayavadis. They're calling each other Narayan. You know, but they're not Narayan. They're still a jiva. So that's the whole point. Is that's why Krishna's making this point over and over and over again, that it's not by, you know, it's not by our intelligence, it's not by our activities, our karma, our good qualities. None of this will produce Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness comes from Krishna consciousness. If I want to start a business, okay, then why do I do the business? To make money, okay? So what do I need in the beginning to start the business?
Money.
Money generates money. So spirit will generate spirit. Bhakti generates bhakti. So this idea, I'm going to take intelligence, which has nothing to do with that, and I'm going to make. Like that. So it doesn't work. You know? It doesn't work. It's not intelligent. Though they have nice mechanical intelligence, but unless it's used by the soul for transcendental benefit to the soul, they're a fool. You know what I'm saying? That's the thing. You know, it's like using one of those Fabergé eggs, you know, as a paperweight or something. That's foolish. Why would you do that? You know, or even worse, is they use it as, you know, for playing cricket or something.
So then, coming in contact with devotees and being connected to the chit potency, then the spiritual intelligence begins to manifest.
Yes, then you start to use the spiritual intelligence, because the spiritual intelligence is always there, but it's something different, right? Is the university giving you a degree because of your spiritual intelligence?
Mm-hmm.
No, like that. So, what do they have to do with each other? Right. They're two different things. Yeah, does that make sense? Let's say someone is, let's say you have the person at work and you have the person at home. Now, do we have cases where the person is great at work but has no idea what to do at home?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, generally speaking, if they know how to deal at home and that, and the family is very satisfied and happy, they deal with their friends, everybody's happy, you'll see that at work.
Yes.
That's the whole point. You have the spiritual, it includes the material, despite what fools say. But if you have the material, you have zero access to spiritual. You know? And that's zeros on a good day. Because that just means you're neutral. But if you're against the Vedic version, it starts to go into the negative. You know, then we start getting to going towards absolute zero, which is like, what, minus 200 and something?
73.
Huh?
273.
273, yeah. So they start to lose out. You understand? So that's why we're saying it doesn't depend on this. It's just bhakti. Bhakti comes from bhakti. You have that faith, anartas go away. You don't have that faith, the anartas very comfortably stay. Right? Maybe anartas where you don't have attachments will go away. Right? You know, you give up that desire to, you know, how you say, you know, go at 200 kilometers an hour down Marine Drive. Maybe you give that one up. But this idea that I got a degree, I'm so intelligent and all that, if we hold on to that, we won't become as steady in devotional service as we can. We won't understand bhakti fully. But when we agree that bhakti only can generate bhakti, nothing else, it has nothing to do with your material qualifications, like zero to do with it. And only by bhakti can we gain devotional service. And we have that faith that it includes, and not only will it give bhakti, bhakti is the one, it's the source of all other religious processes. Right? Then you come to the point of being stable in Krishna consciousness. From there, then very quickly you get a taste, then you get that attachment, you move into rati. But as long as we think is no, because I'm qualified, I'm a professional, I have a degree, I have, you know, that worldly experience, therefore I'm a better devotee, or devotional service is going to get better because of this, you will never come to that, really be solidly fixed in devotional service. You understand? So we have to be very careful. Someone may be in more goodness, so they tend to follow rules, so therefore they do. It's just like in India, people generally tend to get up a little bit earlier. Mm. Right? So to get up earlier in India is no big deal. Right? So therefore, it looks like, you know, and they're used to sitting down, a little meditation, a little chanting, a little puja. So you just, that's the advantage. But it can also be a disadvantage because we become conditioned by the mode of goodness, so we think that mode of goodness, that's devotional service. And then we just fall into the trap of, you know, our material, how you say? Our material, you know, qualifications, that's now bhakti. Does that make sense? Yeah. So here's then the acharyas are trying to get rid of all these kind of misconceptions that come up because of attachment to, you know, the body, the mind, the words. Like that. Because all these are that. Or the negative of that, you're injecting body, mind, and words, like we see the Buddhists and the Mayavadis, and so we want to have nothing to do with that. Like that. So that makes sense. But they think they're smart. They do. Mayavadis think they're really, really smart. Yes.
My devotee told us that Srimad Bhagavatam has said that if we have material mode of goodness, it will be more difficult to us to be attached to devotional service. And he gave examples that King Prachana Bhattisha, it was more difficult for Narada Muni to explain something to King Prachana Bhattisha. And his conclusion was that for people in Sattva Guna more difficult to accept Krishna Bhakti. But I also read in a book of Shivaram Swami, he told that in time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, people were more pious, more sattvic, and that's why for them, process of anatomy were more easy than for us. And my question is, modern goodness, it's a problem for us, or it can help us?
It means mode of goodness is the platform that you function from, and you're trying to get to pure goodness. So if one's already in goodness, then it's easy. The difficulty comes up is the weakness comes up is that one's satisfied materially in goodness, and so therefore you don't see the need for going beyond that. Well, someone in passion and ignorance, they see that there's problems, so they're looking for a solution. So when you present pure goodness, they'll tend to accept the pure goodness. Right? So now the one, if they do accept the pure goodness, if they're in goodness and accept the pure goodness, then for them it's easy because they're already situated in goodness. So the practices, the Krishna consciousness, or the religious practices for them are easy. And then it's just a matter of understanding the philosophy properly. Well, someone in mode of passion and ignorance, then they have that drive to accept the philosophy, but they don't have the practice to function in goodness. So then for them, for the one, the religion is easy, the philosophy may be difficult, and for the other, the philosophy is easy, the religion is difficult. So that's what Prabhupada says. Philosophy without religion is mental speculation, and religion without philosophy is sentiment. So like that, then you have to have both. But the point is those in goodness, if it's like, okay, you could say it's harder to convince him. Okay, so then after those chapters of
Puranjana.
Yeah, Puranjana, the discussion. Now, if you sat down straight and just read through that very nicely, you know, in a dramatic reading, so it's working at a natural speed, right? How long would it take? Right?
One day.
Yeah, even if it took a day. Okay, after that day, he was convinced of pure devotional service and took it up. So, how is that? Well, what is he talking about? That's difficult. How many people you know, you sat down, preached to them for a day, and then they took up pure devotional service with determination?
Yeah, so they were coming to the temple for 10 years, finally just focused on for a day.
Yeah, okay, yes, but it's because you got disagree. So the point is that's, it's not a good position to take. You only take that position if someone is by nature in the mode of goodness. They're proud of it, and that pride is getting in the way of them moving forward. So they're conditioned by goodness. Then you bring this up, just to make them aware. But if someone's situated in passion and ignorance, and you're telling everyone is that, well, this is a better position, that's like saying, we're Occidental, not Oriental, therefore we're actually better. It's like, it's just pure nonsense. It means I don't even want to compare it to the dung of a bull, because bulls are represent religion, so I wouldn't want to offend the bull dung. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the difficulty, is that you have this idea is that we're of a lower nature, we're better. You know, we're from the hood, so, you know, we know what's going on. Yeah, you know what's going on in the hood, but, you know, who wants to live in the hood? You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so that's the difficulty, is that you can use that, but you only use that on someone who's proud of the mode of goodness. Then you point out that it's not so good. Prabhupada do that all the time. Someone gets too proud of, even they get too proud of the Vedic, he'll point out that, you know, I see someone's talking about, you know, the Ayurveda and the modern medicine, this and that, and that's all bogus and all that. And Prabhupada said, no, well, they've advanced quite a lot. You know, Prabhupada didn't have much good to say about modern medicine. He'd always talk about the Ayurveda. But if someone was thinking that Ayurveda, that's what makes Krishna consciousness, then it's no, it doesn't. Being Krishna conscious makes Krishna consciousness. So anything that there's an over attachment to any mode, you want to give that up. Right? But if someone's attached to goodness, at least they can follow their religion. Now you have to get through to them the philosophy. Right? Does that make sense? So they have less gross anarthas. It doesn't mean they don't have some serious subtle ones, like Indra. He's situated in goodness, you know, by nature, being a demigod, but he has a few anarthas, you know, a few obstacles. Does that make sense? So generally speaking, you'll see, as we'll always point out, being situated in goodness, that's the better position. But if someone's proud of it, then we'll bring out that it's still mundane. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like you have the ordinary person. Then someone who's successful materially will consider themselves better. And therefore they have the skills and that for Krishna consciousness. Then better than that will be the intellectual. He'll think he's even better than all of them. So these kind of things, these pride has to be removed. That's why it points out karma and gyan. Qualification karma and gyan is not a qualification for bhakti. Right? That's why you have, you know, examples like Magrari the hunter. Right? You know, we're not dealing with any good qualities here at all. Right? He can't even do his job properly. He only half kills the animal. He's even bad as a hunter. Right? And so there's nothing good there. And then by here, association with Narad Muni, that's how he becomes a devotee. In a sense. So that has to be there. And then, whatever your position, if you have good qualities, you have good intelligence, you have good skills, great, use them for Krishna. It's an asset. It's an ornament on the soul. But until you understand what's the soul, it's not an ornament. You know, that's why ornament on a dead body is like, so what? You know, what's the big deal? So you're trying to point out what's real. And so that's why sometimes it seems confusing. Like Prabhupada will talk about human life begins with varnashram. If you're not following varnashram, you're functioning less than human life. Advantage of Krishna consciousness is about the soul. So any living entity in any position, even, you know, he says, you know, chanting Hare Krishna, then he's saying even a child can do it, even a dog can do it. Right? So that means is that our advantage of moving forward Krishna consciousness is not because of our great qualification, it's because of the qualification of the holy name. Right? So if one doesn't accept varnashram, you'll still move forward. But the point is it's like trying to walk with it dragging a weight behind you. You know, why not just get rid of the weight, you know? So then it's just easier. The varnashram is meant for humans to how humans can interact with each other, with other living entities, with Krishna's energy, with Krishna. It's like the perfect system. No other system has that ability. It just doesn't have. There may be a few points that are good, but it's not complete. So he's made that statement, and he'll talk for, you know, some paragraphs about this. But then having said all that, then he'll make the point that, but varnashram is not enough, so just, you know, you have to be at devotional service. So then, much of the time, devotees will take it, see, Prabhupada's rejecting varnashram. So he's rejecting that varnashram itself is enough. Right? It's just that you're human, great. The demigods are also human. Right? So many humans. But if you're not engaging yourself in Krishna's service, you're kind of missing the point. Right? You get no, the soul gets no benefit. So that it's just, you have to see the context of Prabhupada's talking. It's pure devotion is the real thing. And then you try to situate yourself in the human platform, because Krishna is doing what pastimes? He's famous for Malecha Yavana pastimes? Or he's famous for human pastimes? So human means varnashram. So you see, he functions within that. In the Vrindavan, he's a cowherd boy. In Dwarka, he's a king. Or he's a prince. And he follows all the rules that go with those places. The interaction. Right? He respects his mother. Then you have Purnamasi, he's like the grandmother. You know, his father is the king of Vrindavan. You know, the cowherd boys are his friends. So he's following all the different things. It's the basis of this interaction. So varnashram, the purpose of it, is for proper interaction, right? But if it's not connected to Krishna, it only creates material, you know, facility and reaction. You're nice to people, things go nicely. You know, you're nasty to people, things, you know, after a while fall apart. Right? You know, it's just like you go down to the office or something like that to get some work done. You're nice. But when you leave, you don't make some snide comment. Because you think, okay, I'm done here. But then you find out that there's another paper you have to sign. Now you're going to go back and that guy that you were nasty to is not going to sign your paper. Right? So no, it's just varnashram's proper dealings. So it creates the prosperity in which the body can be comfortably maintained. And in the body, we mean the gross and the subtle. So people looking for emotions and community and feelings and support, and that's in varnashram. It's not in the modern society. Where is it in the modern society? Right? You see, old societies, huh?
Online.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Virtual. Virtual reality. Yeah. Yes, and so. There, you don't have that satisfaction and all that. So that's why it's recommended. So human life starts there, and human life is meant to be engaged in Krishna consciousness. Right. So it's just a matter of, if someone gets too off track, that no, it's the intelligence, it's the good qualities, it's the good work ethic or the good abilities, or, you know, all these different things, then we have comments to say. And if they're not, they're just humbly trying to engage themselves in Krishna's service, then it's a glory. You know, oh, he's so intelligent, he's engaging nicely in Krishna's service, or he has such nice qualities, that's why he's able to serve so nicely. We'll say these things. But if somebody becomes proud of it or thinks that that's what's causing devotional service, then we'll say no. That's foolish. So there's always this balance. The razor's edge means you have to stay on that edge. And if someone veers off, then they're off. So you have to make comments, so go back. Does that make sense? Yeah. The second argument is based on the distinction between the perceiver and the perceived. The body and mind cannot be observer because they are objects of perception. Thus the perceiver, the soul, must be different from them. Right? So one, you're talking about the transformation, so therefore these, the eternal. The temporary, the other is the perception. Right? So they kind of mush that all together, and that they take it, the perception is the consciousness, and it's temporary, so therefore then they don't make the distinction, because they don't know their soul, so all they have is nothingness. Right? And so if they have somethingness, then the somethingness is all, just like nothingness, it's all the same, so somethingness is all the same. They make enough distinction to make up a philosophy, but not enough for it to actually be a useful philosophy. Right? It means its point as a philosophy is to make people peaceful. That's its only purpose. Right? It can't go beyond that. That's what Buddha gave it for. They just become nonviolent. You know, that's... Does that make sense? Well, in yoga, you can become nonviolent and know the Lord. Mm-hmm. So it's a better system. But, you know, you start with whatever you got. The guy's a Buddhist, then great. You know, he's willing to sit and talk to you. Right? Discuss philosophy. Vritti. In the next Anucheda, Srila Jiva Goswami gives further logic to help distinguish the self from the body. Anucheda 54. Giving an example, the realization of the unchanging Atma with destruction of the sense functions is shown. Andeshu, Peshishu, Tarushvani, Chetishu, Prano, Hi, Jivam, Upa, Dhavati, Tatra, Tatra, Sanne, Yad Indriya Gane Hami Cha Prasupte Kutastha Asayam Rite Tad Anu Smritir Naha. Prana follows the jiva in bodies born from eggs, wombs, seed, and perspiration. Right? So that means that's all the living entities. It means 8,400,000 fit into these four categories. When the senses and ahankar cease to function in deep sleep, the fixed atma alone remains, without the covering of the subtle body, but with memory of the experience of deep sleep. Srimad Bhagavatam 11:3-39. Prana follows the jiva in bodies born from eggs, andeshu, wombs, peshishu, seeds, tarushu, and perspiration, avinish, Chetishu. In this example, the unchanging nature of the Atma is shown in various bodies. Then the unchanging nature in one body is shown. The Atma seems to change when, yat, the senses are active and in the waking state. When in a dreaming condition, the ahankar remains active, holding impressions of the senses. When in deep sleep, with the senses and ahankar, ahami, merge, sanne, in the Atma, the Atma remains unchanged, kutastha. Why? It is devoid of upadis of the subtle body, asayamrite. The cause of change, the upadis, is absent, having been dissolved. Right? So deep sleep means that there's no upadis. Right? There's nothing that you're focusing on there. So then dreaming state or that is then where the upadi is there. Your identity is there and the things connected with it, the impressions. And so you're still going on in that kind of condition. Does that make sense? So the more you absorb yourself in that, you see the less less one has, how you say, the more one has trouble sleeping. Right?
Yes.
Well?
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Sorry?
I didn't hear.
You didn't hear? That the, how you say, the more you're absorbed in your upadis, the more trouble you'll have sleeping, because the dream state means you're still identifying with them. Deep sleep means you give it up. That's why you see kids can sleep so easily, because you know how much identity and ego is there. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandini.